I am getting a steak. I'm going, when I fly back to LA tomorrow, I'm going to the Buggy Whip restaurant and getting a giant fucking steak. Yeah. You heard me. I enjoy steak too much because I hate hippies so much. You know what I mean? I enjoy it more than I think I actually enjoy it. Every time you eat a steak, like a hippie's hacky sack goes down the gutter. And you're like, oh, man. Oh, dude, what the fuck, man? Every time you eat a steak, a hippie's hacky sack goes into the sewer. Always remember that. And I like to, I mean, I'll go to Lowry's and Ruth's Chris, the really high-end steakhouses. But I'll go to the shitball steakhouse. I don't care. Outback, Black Angus, I'm there. It's steak! Not so much Black Angus, though. Because remember how friendly the ads for Black Angus used to be? They're like, come on in, have a steak. How about a baked potato? You're like, fucking, how about, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow night. Table for two, 7:15. Now, the ads for Black Angus, have you noticed how it's turned into this gauntlet of angry food? It's like they're almost like challenging you. Like, at Black Angus, we'll start you off with our appetizer platter featuring five jumbo deep-fried Gulf shrimp served on a disc of salted butter with 15 of our potato bacon bombs and a big bowl of pork cracklings with our cheese and butter dipping sauce. You're like, We're all going to split that. Oh, you'll each get your own. Then we'll take you to our mile-long soup and salad bar featuring bacon and cheese cream soup and our five head of iceberg lettuce He-Man salad served in a punch bowl with 18 pounds of ranch dressing, pork stuffed deep-fried croutons, and what the hell, a couple of corn dogs. Hey, man, I'll tell you what. I'll get, like, a mixed green salad. Hey, I'll suck a cock on the Golden Gate Bridge before I bring you a mixed green, buddy. Then we'll wheel out our bottomless trough of fried dough. Wait a minute. Am I getting a steak? Oh, you'll get a fucking steak. Because then we'll bring out our 55-ounce Los Mesa He-Man steak slab, served with a deep-fried pumpkin stuffed with buttered scallops and 53 of our potato bacon bombs. Oh, dude, I don't think... And then bend over, Abigail May, because here comes a gravy pipe! What? Black Angus, doors are locked from the outside, faggot! But... When did I? At Black Angus, your name is Peaches. All right.
Oh, all right. Jesus, so angry. How's it going, people? Are you happy? Hey, Michelle Obama, she's turning into a real food Nazi lately, isn't she? She was on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. I'm not sure if you guys caught this clip. She was on with Gabby Douglas, the Olympic gold medalist, the gymnast. Leno asks her if, you know, she did anything to treat herself after winning the gold medal. And she said, yeah, I had some fast food. I had an Egg McMuffin. And Michelle Obama is sitting right next to her. She just goes apeshit. She goes, no, don't, you can't say that. You're setting me back, Gabby. And, you know, I'm like, well, come on. She just won a gold medal. Let her eat a freaking Egg McMuffin. Big deal. Then President Obama is starting a campaign. He's in Iowa. And he says, I'm heading to your state fair, but my wife told me that I couldn't have a fried Twinkie. And I'm thinking, you know, this is the president of the United States. The man wants a deep-fried Twinkie. I think he's entitled to that. You know, he's put up with you bossing him around for 4 years in that house, living with your mom. He has Bin Laden killed and is about to head into a real tough battle here this fall against Romney. Let the man eat a fucking Twinkie, for Christ's sake, you know? Listen, I'm all for eating right, but lay off sometimes. It gets really annoying. You know, listen, guess what? Over the weekend, I ate two double doubles. Come get me. Well, today we're talking about fish and fishing and overfishing. And, you know, we've hit on it before. But when I was growing up, you know, I loved fishing. And I think all kids love fishing, and I think there's a reason for that. I loved it up until, I don't know, my late 20s into my 30s. And I don't know what exactly it was that turned me off to fishing. But, you know, for a while, I started to have all these different ideas about why I didn't like fishing. And I knew I've always had a hard time eating the fish that I would catch. And for the longest time, I thought it was because I felt guilt over having taken its life. And eating it made me feel even guiltier. But it never made sense that I couldn't take responsibility enough to make sure that the fish didn't die in vain. And then I didn't know if it was that or I felt like I didn't want to waste the lives of the fish, or maybe it was that I just didn't enjoy spending half a day on a boat or on a shoreline, mostly waiting for absolutely nothing to happen. Because listen, when you're younger, or when we were younger, at least back in the days in, you know, the 70s, we were pulling fish out of the water at a lightning pace. We always caught fish, and it was fun. And as the years wore on, we caught less fish, so frustration and boredom sets in, and the idea of wasting a day out on a lake when we could have been doing something else like surfing, playing tennis, riding bikes, or just hanging out by the pool, you know, it started to get old. And I later realized that it wasn't the guilt of having taken the fish's life that kept me from eating it. It was the taste of the fish that kept me from eating it. I do not like the taste of trout or bass. Doesn't do anything for me. Or any panfish, which is what we were catching a lot of. Catfish is another story. I never had a problem eating catfish, whether I caught it or someone else caught it. And fish from the ocean, for the most part, also never a problem for me. It was the idea of fishing that turned me off to fishing. I just lost my zest for hunting animals. It made more sense for me that if I wanted to eat fish, I would just go to the store, buy the fish I wanted, bring it home, prepare it, and be done with it. And that's why I really appreciate that there are fishermen out there who will catch or raise fish for us to eat. It's not a job I would ever want now, but I'd have jumped at the opportunity when I was eight. When I was eight, I honestly thought I was going to grow up and become a professional fisherman. Like one of those, you know, NASCAR looking dudes who's with a shirt with all those logos on it, sitting on a boat, bringing in bass. I was watching Roland Martin and Bill Dance. I mean, I was really on it. I mean, I loved that stuff. And I never realized that the fish population was really falling, which is why the days of pulling fish after fish out of the water is a distant memory for me. But then you think about it, when you're young, that's all there is. You don't care if you're not catching fish. You're out there. You're doing it. You're playing in the water. It's something that is enjoyable for kids, and it's something that's enjoyable for old people, because I just think that then it doesn't matter what you're doing, just the fact that you're outside. Because think about it. When you get older, what starts to happen? What are the two things that are available to you when you're older that aren't available when you're young? Beer or alcohol and sex. Now, I would much rather be hanging out by the pool drinking or being inside having sex than I would be out sitting on a lake, you know, doing nothing. Anyway, today we're going to talk about a subject that we've been hitting on many times in the 5 years that this show has been rolling along. But every now and again, it bears repeating because the situation doesn't seem to be getting any better, only worse. Now, look, a lot of people are going to say, I think that a lot of this stuff is made up, that they're trying to, you know, increase the cost of fish, or that the EPA just generally needs something to do. That may be true. We may not have a shortage, but it certainly appears to me that there is one. And there are so many things happening in the ocean right now that, you know, it's a cause for concern.
Hey, dude, we don't get a chance to talk about homebrew a lot on the show, and we don't, you know, really review it because it's not something everyone can just go buy in the market.
Yeah, exactly. You can't really get it unless you're at the brewer's home.
Well, you hadn't brewed in a while, and we brewed a beer together back in February.
That's right. That's right. And I still have some left.
And we're still have a lot left.
Yeah. You have more than most people would have after brewing in February.
It's aging well.
Yeah. So we're going to have it today. It's an IPA. Double IPA?
I would consider it a double.
Yeah, because it went to 7.6, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just under 8. So let's pop her open. That's not bad.
He does have a Sacramento Brewing cap in honor of our good friend Peter.
Yes.
Who was making that place everything it was.
Sac Brew, RIP.
So sad that place went down, man. Yeah, he made so much good beer there. Nice fat head, nice lacing. It's got a nice, even amber body to it. Mm-hmm. Reeks of hops.
What did we use here? We used Chinook and...
Chinook and Centennial?
Centennial, I think,
Yeah, we dry hopped with... we did the final. We did the flame out with Centennial and then the dry hop.
Dry hop with Chinook. Or was Centennial, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was Centennial.
Oh, okay. So we finished with Centennial and dry hopped with it.
That's right.
Nice.
Yeah. And then we did the bittering and aroma with Chinook.
Yeah. We used just a regular California ale yeast on this? Chico yeast? Yeah. Oh, it's lovely. Sweet. Not a lot of bite. The aroma on the aroma is fantastic.
Yeah, I like the aroma on this a lot. Yeah, it came out really well. Good stuff.
You know, I still get emails about that video we did, the How to Homebrew on Dude Night.
Oh, with the...
your big tower.
The pilot tower.
You know, if you're going to teach people how to brew, the last thing you want to do is show them how to do all grain. And it looks so intense. I mean, the only people who were really interested in it were people who had been brewing before and go, how the fuck do I get one of those towers?
Well, we kind of made it look easy. I mean, from the way it was laid out.
Yeah.
I mean, it looked like there were a lot of steps, but with... You know, kind of the three of us doing it, it made it look pretty easy.
It was fun, though.
It was great. Yeah, it's fun. It's doing all grain by yourself sucks.
No, it does. It's a long day thing, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of cleaning, a lot of everything involved.
When I teach people how to brew, it's usually I use an extract and some specialty grains, so they don't have to go through all these extra steps, and because I don't want to scare them off. I don't want it to taste like, you know, Mr. Beer, but I want it to be good beer, but I don't want it to be, you know, too... A little more steps than what you do with Mr. Beer, where you just, you know, throw the shit in a bucket, add some water, throw the yeast in, and you're done.
Yeah, cross your fingers and you're done. No, no, definitely. I mean, this is extract with some all grain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were at this place called Brew in Lake Forest today.
Brew.
This kid, I've been teaching him how to brew. Dave, if you're listening, hey, Dave. He was brewing his IPA today. And it was, you know, he had some questions. He brewed it on his own after doing the first brew with me. And this guy, the waiter, came up and he said, you know, he taught this guy how to brew. And this guy wouldn't stop brewing. It was like, you know, he wanted to brew like every other weekend and stuff. And
yeah, he was on the crack run.
Anybody who's not brewed before, once you start brewing and you see just how easy it really is, and the product is, it's quality. Yeah, it's addicting.
Very addicting. Yeah.
But this beer is... I'll tell you, man, this is a product of really good homebrew and a lot of experience.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Thanks. I like it.
Sweet. I like the malt. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's piney, not even citrusy. It's almost more like an East Coast style IPA. Like 60 Minute style.
I wouldn't quite go that far.
Why? Because you don't like them?
Well, hey, I'm SoCal.
The fuck is wrong with you?
I'm SoCal.
You fucking snob.
That's it.
How dare you?
Welcome to the club. That's good. I like it.
You don't think this has more of an East Coast feel to it?
No, because East Coast would be a lot sweeter.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. No, there's still plenty of hop in this, but it's more, I mean, the taste on it is pretty well balanced on a high end.
Do you know the difference between a West Coast IPA and an East Coast IPA, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. East Coast IPAs are like, oh, yeah, I'm hoppy, yeah, it's all hoppy.
Yeah, this is whipkin hoppy, yeah.
Well, this has been Hog Dog's IPA, Don's special IPA, his re-emergence in brewing. And I hope he makes more beer, man.
Yeah, four-year hiatus.
Yeah. Well, you're back.
I'm back. I'm back. I'll do it more than once a year, too.
Now, I've got a big rack of cookbooks, a pretty good size rack, I guess. I don't know. It certainly isn't the size of Charles Thompson's collection. Charles from 100 Miles. This dude, he goes, I got a lot of cookbooks. I show up to his house. He's got a bookcase in his living room full of cookbooks. Then takes me into his office where he has two full cases of cookbooks. He's got more cookbooks. I don't know. If he's cooking one recipe a day out of those things, I think he can cook for a year easy. This is amazing. Anyway, some of my cookbooks are just kind of novelty books because I just like them, and they each one has like a different meaning for me. But one of my favorites, and you'll laugh, comes from Dom DeLuise, and it's called Eat This, It'll Make You Feel Better. And he had a second one I bought called Eat This Too. And basically it was about home-cooked Italian food, American Italian food. And there is a difference. There is a difference. When some of the things that we do here in America, we have Americanized Italian food, but it still is comfort food, and a lot of the stuff is stuff that I remember eating as a kid, and it just kind of passes along from generation to generation. But one of the dishes that he has here that I made recently is very comforting and very cool. It's called Mama's Italian Fish Stew, and he dedicated the book. And this book is from the 80s, I think. I bought it. I don't remember when I bought it, but he dedicated it to his mom, Vincenza. And she said, you know, if you woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, if you came home at 3 in the morning and you told her you were hungry, she'd get up, she'd cook for you. And she was a very kind woman and a very, very good cook, underestimated. Anyway, her Italian fish stew, his father loved the dish. And as it was being served, he'd just sit and he'd smile and really, really loved it. Now, so I made it, and I'm putting a link on the website. Actually, a link. I'm going to put the whole recipe on the website for you and kind of give you an idea of what's going on here. The ingredients are pretty simple. You don't have to use the kinds of fish that he calls for. I used calamari. I used, what else I used? I used scallops. I had some bay shrimp, and I think that's it. Those are the fish I used. But you can use chunked fish if you like. You can use anything you want, really. But the fish goes in at different times. But he calls for... basically, in a large kettle, heat 4 tablespoons of olive oil, all right, on medium heat, and then add some garlic. You're going to add about 3 garlic cloves that you've minced, 1 onion that you've chopped up, a large tomato that you've diced, 1 green pepper that you've chopped up, 1 red pepper that you've also chopped up, 1 celery stalk that you've chopped, and get that sautéed nice and lightly, and don't take on any color. You just want to kind of make everything a little translucent and get it soft. And then we're going to add some wine. Or you want to add beer, you can add beer. 1 cup of dry white wine. You can use Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc. Or if you want to use beer, you can use, you know, some kind of a light beer, light-colored beer. And then we're going to add some crushed tomatoes. 2 28-ounce cans of crushed tomatoes and an 8-ounce bottle of clam juice. Now listen, clam juice is one of those things, I don't know if we're going to see it for long in the grocery store. And if you walk the aisles of the grocery store, you'll notice some things are starting to kind of disappear because people don't buy them. And you go down that canned fish aisle and you wonder how many people are buying some of the stuff in there. Like, I think sardines are still popular, anchovies are still popular, tuna fish definitely. Canned salmon, as it turns out, is safe to eat. I didn't know that. I wouldn't eat it, but they say it's safe. And clam juice is one of those things that I don't know many people are using anymore. Anyway, if you can find it, which you should for now, an 8-ounce bottle of clam juice, which on its own smells kind of funky. Anyway, you got all that going. Bring it to a boil. Lower the heat to a simmer. And then you're going to throw in, if you're using squid or calamari, throw that in first because it takes a while to cook. And cook that for 3 minutes. Now, he calls for 1/2 pound of calamari, which is basically squid. That's been skinned and cleaned and then cut into small circular rings. And then if you want to use some white fish like cod or red snapper, put about 1/2 pound of that in and simmer that for about 10 more minutes. And at this point, you want to add a little water, okay? Because, you want the stew to be a little thick, but you want to add some liquid to it because, you know, it can't just be nothing. You've got to add something. And I like some liquid in mine, so I went ahead and added about a cup of water. You don't have to do that if you don't want to, but just be careful. You don't want to overdo it, but don't underdo it either. Season it with some cracked black pepper, and then throw in 1/2 teaspoon of oregano and 1/4 teaspoon of thyme. Both of those should be fresh. If you can get them fresh, use them fresh. And at this point, if you want to add some shrimp and some scallops or clams, you can throw those in. Again, about 1/2 pound of everything. And cook that for another 5 minutes. And that should be it. Turn off the heat. Put a top on it. If the clams don't open, toss them, okay? If they are opened when you go to put them in the stew, toss those. If they're opened early, throw them away. If they don't open, throw them away. Those are bad. They'll make you sick. So that's it. You serve it in large bowls with some hot Italian bread, and he says big, big napkins. It's a great recipe. I'm going to put a link to this book on the website, too, if you want to check it out. But the recipe is fantastic. And, again, one of those things that, I make dishes out of this, like, you know, his grandmother's gravy and sausage with peppers and onions and all sorts of other, like polenta, things like that. And it's literally, it's Americanized Italian food, like I said, and there's just something very comforting about it.
We're going to turn now to an important headline about fish that could have on your dinner plate. Some bluefin tuna off the California coast are carrying radioactive contamination from that nuclear plant that started leaking after last year's earthquake in Japan. ABC's Lindsay Davis here with the details. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning, George. Researchers admit they were not expecting this. In fact, this is the first time such a large migrating fish has been shown to carry radioactivity so far. And the scientists involved say the results are unequivocal that Fukushima was definitely the source.
Researchers are calling the finding startling. Bluefin tuna arriving off the coast of California all the way from Japan carrying radioactive contamination, apparently leaked from the Fukushima nuclear plant.
We were quite surprised, but there it was.
Researchers from Stony Brook University made the discovery about 5 months after last year's quake and tsunami. The fish had all made the 6,000-mile journey across the Pacific to the U.S. The scientists assume the radioactivity would have been long gone by the time they arrived because big fish like bluefin tuna, which can weigh more than 1,000 pounds, would typically shed radioactive substances easily. But what they found were levels of contamination 10 times higher than amounts measured in previous years. Still, scientists say the levels are well below safe-to-eat limits and are not likely to affect humans.
I imagine that the consumption of these tuna would be far, far below the radioactivity that you would get from, for example, one dental x-ray.
There are other radioactive foods that we eat on a regular basis, bananas, Brazil nuts, carrots, green leafy vegetables, and we're still seeing levels that are below levels of concern even in those foods.
Researchers say the real test will come this summer when they repeat the study on bluefin tuna that have been swimming in radioactive waters for about three times as long. They also plan on testing other migratory animals to see what those levels
are. So no danger yet, but we have to keep an eye on it.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so let me get this straight. We have a bluefin tuna shortage, and you guys are doing scientific experiments on a bunch of them that just happen to swim to our shores? Oh, listen, at least I hope someone got a chance to taste some of it during your wacky experiments, Dr. Frankenstein. What the hell is that? Seriously, though, no, I'm joking, but it's kind of crazy, right? And again, these fish, this happens all the time. It's not going to hurt you. You know, I'm still going to eat that fish. But you got to wonder, you know, they've been talking about a bluefin tuna shortage for a very, very long time. And you wonder if some of this is scare tactics to stop you from eating fish. I don't know. It's hard to say. But it is cause for concern, and we knew this was going to happen. But the beautiful thing is these bluefin tuna are something else, right? Not only are they just spectacular that they can swim so far and get here, but that their bodies can handle that the amount of radiation that were in those fish when they were in Japan probably should have killed them. But they swam and purged it all out. Just an amazing animal. Just something else. And, you know, I read an article on ArsTechnica.com about the global fishing industry and what a rough future it's facing. World economists and ecologists are proposing the spending of $200 billion globally in efforts to restore global fisheries worldwide. They say that this scheme would pay for itself in 12 years and we'd see a net gain of up to $1,400 billion after 50 years, boosting fishing from a loss-making to a profit-making industry. The collapse of a Newfoundland Atlantic cod fishery in the early 90s forced the Canadian government to place a moratorium on cod fishing, which left thousands of people unemployed. And I think that's the thing. There's a lot of collateral damage here. And we're saying, oh, we need to stop fishing. Well, think about this. I mean, you watched that show, Dangerous Catch, right? There's a lot of people out there that are employed. A lot of people that work on these boats. And what are they going to do for work? We're basically, the EPA is basically asking, or whoever's on top of this, the word ecologist kind of scares me sometimes because usually they've got an agenda. But if we stop fishing, there's going to be a lot of people out of work, and I mean thousands. And, of course, they address that. In 2006, there was a report in the journal Science that claimed that one-third of the global fisheries had completely collapsed and predicted that most fish stocks would collapse by 2048 if current practices were to continue. And then a 2009 report claimed that 63% of fisheries were in need of rebuilding. In this new report, this international team of economists and ecologists have a really simple solution. Fish less. No shit, Sherlock. We should fish less? Thank you. Well, I'm glad you did this report. But that's not cheap, and it's not simple. And look, they say right now, the current global fishing capacity is 2.5 times higher than what is required for sustainable levels. 2.6 million, that's 60% of the world's fishing boats, would require decommissioning, meaning you're not going fishing. And between 15 and 22 million, which is 43 to 63% of the world's fishers, would require compensation or retraining. So we're going to stop fishing and then retrain these people or just pay them to be, you know, unemployment. I don't know that this is a solution. Maybe running out of fish isn't that bad. I mean, they argue that this may not be a popular choice, but a managed transition is preferable to having mass unemployment that's been thrust upon the industry, which is what they're faced with. They calculated the cost of downsizing to be between $130 billion and $292 billion, with a mean of $203 billion. Calls for an end to a $19 billion per year in harmful and ambiguous subsidies. That's a tough one, man. That is tough.
Good. Well, we always think of fish as being so good for you, but not always, right?
Well, not always. And I just have to say that this year, just like this last month, the number of fish that are eaten, like that are farm-raised, mm-hmm. surpassed the amount of the fish that are eaten that are just pulled out of the water fresh. And so most of the fish fries that you get will have farm-raised fish.
Okay.
And that introduces elements that can be bad for you.
Okay.
And so that's the concern.
So what is good or bad about the farm-raised?
Well, farm-raised it's important because if we don't have a sustainable way to get that food source, then we're going to overfish our stocks and it's just going to go away.
Okay.
So it's important to have it. But what happens is they have tilapia? The density of fish in their farm-raised system mm-hmm. will be between 7 to 10 fish per cubic foot.
Whoa.
And what that does is it introduces parasites like sea lice, introduces disease. And so what they do with the fish then is they apply vaccines, they apply antibiotics that gets into the meat, which gets into us.
Mm.
What they say is that if you have less than like 3 or 4 of that whitefish mm-hmm. per week, you're still okay.
Okay.
But that's just something to be concerned about. And the whitefish will be healthier than things like farm-raised salmon.
Okay.
There's some caveats around farm-raised.
Salmon's pink. Would that, what about shellfish? Is that separate?
Yeah, that's separate as well. But, the salmon, you know the reason why it's pink?
Why?
Because when it's out in the wild, it eats krill. But the farm-raised salmon doesn't eat krill.
Oh, no.
No, I know.
It
pink? It's, oh, no, is right. Yeah, they turn it pink. They feed it ground up dead fish.
Oh.
And then they'll put dye, synthetic dyes in it.
Oh,
and then
wow.
You know what they have? They have these color wheels. It looks like when you go buy paint, you get these swatches.
Uh-huh.
They give these swatches to the fish farmers and say, what color do you want? And I know. It's
That's
all
gross.
I know. I'm like the bearer of bad news. But what they say is, and what the research says is, that if you have farm-raised salmon less than 3 times per week, then those dyes won't become a problem. If it's more than that, it can harm your retina.
Huh.
So don't have farm-raised salmon 4 times a week.
Okay. What about like wild? How do you know if it's a wild fish?
They have to label.
Okay.
They have to label, and they'll say that. What you're going to notice about farm-raised versus wild fish is that the wild fish is tougher, it's meatier because it's out in the wild, and the others are fatter. They're like couch potato fish. They really are.
Yeah, they don't have very far to go if there's 7 to 10 in a little square foot.
Exactly, and they're fatter, and so it's a little tastier, but the oils are still the omega-3 oils, the good stuff.
Right.
But in farm-raised salmon, there's more of the bad oils, the omega-6 ones, and those two versions use the same enzymes. And so they compete. You don't get as much good salmon oils from farm-raised as you do from wild-caught.
Okay.
That's courtesy of CBS, by the way. And that chick was annoying the shit out of this guy. Uh-huh, every 2 seconds. Kept interrupting him. And he's saying something, and she goes, oh, yeah, salmon's pink. What about shellfish? He looked at her like, what the hell are you talking about? Listen, the bottom line for me, like everything else, I eat fish in moderation. I don't have it that often. But I like to have it. But nothing we do, whether it's farm-raised or wild, nothing we do is going to make that big of a difference. I'll be honest with you. Why? Because in Japan, all throughout Asia, fish is what's for dinner. For the most part, they eat a lot of fish. There's no denying that. And they don't care how difficult it is to catch them. Go catch them. And if we run out, well, then we run out. I think we'd be okay if we didn't have fish, if that does happen. You might remember an interview I had with Martin from I Love Blue Sea a couple of years ago. He talked about eating sustainable seafood only. And, you know, you think it's going to limit the types of fish that you can eat? Yeah, perhaps. Is it safe? Yeah, of course. If you give up some things, you know, the returns sometimes are pretty big. And I went to iloveblue.com lately, and, you know, they sell most of what you're already eating, but a sustainable variety. Now, look, the prices are high. So I don't know. Is it worth it? Maybe. But if you want it, sustainable versions of albacore, sturgeon, yellowtail, snapper, Arctic char, black cod, catfish, halibut, anchovies, mahi-mahi, striped bass, tilapia, king salmon. Not bad. You know, the thing is that people go, well, you know, how do I know what's sustainable? That's a tough one. Because you go to the grocery store, good luck. You've got to have a real education about the fish you're staring at. You don't know what the population is, if the population's strong. You don't know what they used to catch it. You know, they don't know. You don't know that when they were catching this fish, if they were using nets, if there was like what they call bycatch or an incidental catch, which means that something got stuck in the net, brought up on the boat, and then killed. Oops. You don't know if the fish got a chance to reproduce before you caught it. You don't know. And if it's farm raised, you don't know what is being fed. You don't know the ratio of protein in to protein out is. You don't know what they're eating. You don't know if they're using chemicals. You've got to know the species in question. You've got to know the location where it was caught or farmed. You got to know the method that it was caught or the method it was farmed. Or you can just go to a website like I Love Blue Sea and know that everything they sell is certified sustainable by basically what a lot of people consider to be the most trusted source on the subject, which is the Monterey Bay Aquarium here in California. You can buy anything they sell and know that it's okay. If you care. I mean, seriously, if you know that much. And listen, I am not trying to steer anybody away from eating anything by doing this show. I'm just telling you what our options are and how important it is for us to educate ourselves on what is happening in the water. And there's no doubt there are things happening in the water. I mean, out here on the West Coast, we now have some moratoriums in certain areas where you can't fish. And you've got to go out further to catch the fish. And it's hurting these fishermen. I read a report in OC Weekly where some of these guys are just ready to give it up. And they've been doing it for years. They don't know anything else. Their grandfathers fished. Their fathers fished. Everybody in the family fished. And I know, look, we talk about this ad nauseum on the show. 5 years now we've been talking about this. But it bears mentioning now and again, it's not all farm-raised fish that's bad, too. And I've had this argument several times. Not all of it's bad. And I don't know how many of you caught this. No Reservations episode earlier this year on the Croatian coast. Tony visits this tuna farm in this little cove along the coast. They're raising outstanding bluefin tuna the right way that are so good the Japanese are buying them. And one single fish can cost you upwards of $70,000.
Mom, where does tuna come from? Well, these days, if you're talking high-grade, sushi-quality bluefin tuna on the endangered list in most countries, it very well might come from a farm like this one. An underwater farm where sushi, on the hoof, so to speak, swims happily by, frolicking just below, rising to the surface to snack on fresh, all-organic chow.
Do tuna have penises? Do we know?
You'll find out.
Oh, that's not good. I'm not getting anally penetrated by a tuna. Is this mating season?
No, it's finished.
It's finished.
It's basically in July, August.
This is Oli, overseeing operations here off the Croatian coast near Zadar, at only one of a worldwide network of high-quality tuna farms. Hundreds of millions of dollars of sushi swimming around in those nets. And I say sushi because this fish is not intended to end up in a can mixed with mayonnaise or spread on white bread.
Where do they spawn? Is there a separate facility for them to all get together and do their thing, play a little Barry White music, put them in the booth.
Something like that. We won't tell you all the secrets, though. The holy grail in the tuna business is to get them to spawn in captivity.
Yeah.
And we've been able to do that for the last 3 years.
Tell you, Barry White, vodka, and Red Bull.
Biggest one we've taken out of our cages is 1,100 pounds.
Nah, 1,100 pounds. Yeah. Biggest customers, Japan?
Yeah, yeah.
How many tuna in this pen?
300-400.
Whoa. And they'll bid up to, I mean, what, $75,000, $85,000 for a fish sometimes.
Millions of dollars of fish.
And what do they eat?
Various types of fish here, right? This is a fit for us to eat as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah?
Sometimes, you know, if my customers don't believe me, we slice, you know, some of these, you know, and he did sashimi as well.
These creatures are ballistically designed from birth for maximum deliciousness, top price. And what that means is they have to be happy fish. Stress-free fish, healthy, well-fed, and pleasingly plump.
Hey, listen really quick. Eddie Shepard, who we've had on the show before, amazing avant-garde vegetarian chef, released an e-book for the iPad. It's basically a molecular cookbook. It's more like a molecular porn book for your iPad. And I got to tell you, this is one of the most visually stunning things I've ever seen on the iPad. Not just a book, but anything. The book is titled Modernist Vegetarian. And I think it's the future for cookbooks. It's got video embedded in it, really easy to follow step by step, some techniques, real impressive photography. And I got to say, for as pretty as the Alinea cookbook was to look at in print, Eddie's artistry on the plate, really one of the great culinary industry's greatest gifts, I think. I'm not just saying it because Eddie's a good dude and he's a friend of mine or because he sent me an advanced copy and I feel obligated. But I do feel obligated only because I think it's literally jewelry for your iPad or your Retina display. I'm going to put a link on the website to iTunes. You can buy the book for £4 or for you Yanks, like me, that's $6.25. And what kind of cheap bastard would you be to not support one of the greatest young chefs of our generation? And while I'm on the subject of up-and-coming British talent, holy hell, did you catch a look at Kate Middleton during the Olympics? My own, this girl is jaw-dropping beautiful. And before you call me a skeeve, because I realize she's royalty, I think I have a thing for the British. Katrina's ancestors hail from England. My secret dream crush, Kate Beckinsale, Victoria Beckham, and now the Duchess of Cambridge, is that right? At least I'm consistent. Anyway, there's playing with your vegetables, and then there's this book. And the way he paints the plate with edible flowers and foams and spherification and some delicately sliced vegetables, honestly, I think I'd feel guilty if somebody served me this food and I ate it. Because I'd be destroying the work of art on the plate just to satisfy my hunger. And I think what he's doing is actually extending the life of molecular gastronomy or nouveau cuisine or whatever it is that you wish to call it. And he's doing it in the most healthiest of ways. And there's no way you can look at this food and say, that looks horrible, or that would make me sick, or that doesn't look very appetizing. It's beyond any of that. It's respectful. It really is respectful. And I talked with Eddie, and we're going to try to do another interview, hook up again for another interview soon. So stay tuned for that. Listen, one last thing, then I'll cut you guys loose. As a fishing joke. Last week, I had the pleasure of hanging out with my buddy Peter Huey, former head brewer at the now-defunct Sacramento Brewing Company, which I believe I read they just tore down. He's now working as a consultant salesperson for a brewing supply company here on the West Coast. So all those beers that you're drinking from California, Peter is responsible for all the ingredients. So you can thank him every time you raise a glass. Anyway, we're talking about a lot of stuff, and I told him about this show that I'm working on. I'm doing some research on fish and fishing, and he said, you've got to include Sean Paxton's recipe for Waterzooey. And I go, what the hell's Waterzooey? Never heard of it. Turns out it's a traditional fish stew from Flanders. It's beautiful. It looks fantastic. Well, listen, when we see Flanders, all I think about is Belgian beer, nothing else. This looks great. He pulls up homebrewchef.com on his phone, shows me the recipe, and yeah, it looked just downright delicious. Chef Paxton, I've said this before too, true artist, very talented chef, cooks right in the heart of Belgium and France with beer. And on the website, I'm going to put a link to Sean's page. It has a recipe on it. You can go there, complete with pictures, very simple recipe. And I've yet to make this dish, But I can safely say in the fall, this is the kind of dish you want to make. First day of cool weather we have again, I'm making this. And best of all, it requires beer in the recipe and pairs beer with it too. So, you know, they don't call him the homebrew chef for nothing. So on his website, Sean wrote, as the nights are cool and the sound of rain patters on the roof. Can we get some music? Yeah, some nice music. As the nights are cool and the sound of rain patters on the roof, the flavor of Waterzooi will warm the soul. A traditional Flemish dish of Ghent, this main course showcases wonderful aromatic vegetables and fresh local fish in a thick stew-like soup. Nice. And that's a wrap. The ingredient list, nothing fancy. Butter, olive oil, shallots, leeks, fennel, carrots, celery, Yukon Gold potatoes, fish stock or vegetable stock, beer, bay leaf, thyme, heavy cream, 2 pounds of fresh fish like halibut, sturgeon, monkfish, or cod, salt and pepper, mussels, chervil or Italian flatleaf parsley. You go shopping and you put all those things in your basket. Anybody worth their salt in the kitchen could tell you that you're cooking something French or Belgian. Chef Paxton is Julia Child with a beard and a deep voice. And I'm out. Thank you for taking the time to listen. Thanks to ABC News, CBS, Travel Channel, and Patton Oswalt for the audio. Music in this episode from Static X and Plitchers. If you like the music, visit the website mylifeisafoodie.com. And you can buy the songs for 99 cents. And while you're there, you can also join our fantastic Facebook group. Follow us on Twitter and then subscribe to the channel on YouTube. And don't miss another episode of Out to Lunch. And that is a wrap. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie.